kid, that book was the coolest book I had. That's the book I learned how to tail somebody from. That's the book I learned how to take fingerprints. I learned how to chase a crime scene. And I still remember all of those techniques. And I wanted for a bunch of years to write a similar book for tradecraft. Because now we have some new generations who don't know how to do a dead drop, who don't know how to shake a tail, who don't know how to do a semaphore or a live pass. And that seems like a shame, because now we're moving into a world where this might become important again. So I want to talk a bit about that. Now, what's interesting about this area is the threat model is real different than what you're used to in normal cryptography. Normal cryptography prevents the enemy from knowing the contents of a communication that he knows exists. So Alice wants to talk to Bob through email. Alice sends Bob an encrypted email. The fact that Alice is sending Bob an email is public knowledge. The contents of that email is secret. Spycraft, on the other hand, deals with the secrecy of the communication. You have a Chinese dissident. I'm probably going to use the Chinese dissident metaphor. I'm not trying to pick on anybody. There are lots of evil bugaboos in the world we can use. I'll just use the Chinese dissident. Wants to communicate some description of a human rights abuse to Amnesty International. It's much more important for him to hide the fact that he is communicating to a human rights observer than it is for him to hide the content of the communication. In fact, he wants that communication to become public. He just has to protect his own person from arrest, from torture, from whatever due process they have or don't have in China. So I'm looking at that problem of a person trying to hide his actions from an adversary that is extremely well-funded, that is a major government, that is the Chinese government, that is the U.S. government, that is some large entity. Now, over the past 20, 30 years, this game has changed. You start reading World War II accounts of spying, or even early Cold War, 50s, 60s. It was very much a battle of wits, of who had the better techniques. Increasingly, it turns into a battle of technology. You start reading the newspapers' accounts of different covert operations, and you see little tidbits. After the Tupac Amaru took over the Japanese embassy in Peru, and the Peruvian military went in a beautiful raid, it is worth reading the accounts, managed to kill everybody and sustain no injuries in about a minute and a half. I mean, it sounds like a D&D scenario. So you start reading the accounts and what they did. It turns out that they managed to get microphones into the compound on the shirt buttons of the clothing the Red Cross brought into the prisoners. They managed to get cameras in. In airplane hijacking, the only place that you cannot see from out a window in an airplane is the tail. So what commando will often do is run from like a mile away, straight up the rear of the plane, get to the tail, and they'll inject a pinhole camera in through the floor, and they can see the entire plane. These things come into the news. Things about spy cameras, satellites, resolving in inches if not sub-inches. GPS receivers, tiny, put them on a car, put them on a person, you'll never find them. So we're entering a world where if this extremely well-funded adversary knows that the spy, the covert operator, is operating covertly, that person doesn't stand a chance. Like driving a Tempest van up to your front door, reading your computer screen from a block away. There's a Tempest computer for sale across the way. If you use that while you're here, they're going to put an agent in and drop a camera somewhere in your office or a microphone. You'll never find it. They have budget and technology that the poor downtrodden Chinese dissident can never hope to have. So all I'm looking at is, how can I not be seen? How can I move through this world without attracting notice? So there are a couple of things we can get from traditional spying. In a lot of Cold War moving of data, either photographs or written data or diaries, a lot of work was done in setting up a chain that could be denied, that could be taken down, that could withstand attack without hurting your agent in the field. You might have a high-placed Soviet colonel or general who's passing documents. You care less that the documents don't arrive. You really care if you lose your assets. Your assets are far more important than any of the data. And you would have systems of transferring the secrets to a number of people in such a way that locked out who knew what. You have something called forward secrecy and backward secrecy. If the colonel gives the film to someone, who gives the film to someone else, you don't want the attacker to be able to turn somebody and then what's called roll up the network. Just go backwards. Okay, who did you get this from? Who did you get this from? Who did you get this from? Back to the colonel. One of the things you would do is you'd set up a dead drop for some of these passes. Dead drops are fairly easy. Person takes message, puts it in known location. Next person finds message from known location. Nice, because if the person gets that data, is caught, he has no clue who he got it from. He cannot turn in his person. In the Walker trial, it came out, they had a number of dead drops. They would drop packets of information in a cigarette packet. They'd throw it on the floor, crumpled, next to a wastebasket in a park in D.C. That's a good example of a dead drop. It's obvious. It's easy to throw, because you're the person throwing it, not to arouse suspicion when he's doing it. And it's easy to pick up. No one's watching you. You know, it's unlikely someone will steal it. Right? You don't want to put a box saying interesting stuff and leave it somewhere because some third party will take it. You know, taping a packet of data to an underside of the phone booth works. These are all traditional dead drops. The problem with that is it's a bit risky in terms of the transfer of the data. The data might get lost. So there'll be a window of time, maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours, where nobody is watching that secret that is lying on the floor somewhere. Another way to do this is a live pass. And it's you get on the bus at a certain time, you stand in a certain place, and then you get off the bus, maybe there's something in your pocket, maybe there isn't. And you don't look. You don't look till afterwards. That's a live pass. Apparently much riskier because it's more obvious. There's a weird TV show on a few years ago. I never watched television. It was the opening segment in a hotel room. It was called Silk Stockings. I have no idea what the show is about, but the opening credits of it gave a really beautiful live pass of a release in a suitcase. It was nicely done. It was a really nice visual. So how can we do this sort of thing on computers? Right, sending an email doesn't work. That's too obvious. Something you could do is to work on newsgroups. And I know this is done. I've done this. Now, I want you to get this piece of information, or I want to know if you can do something. And you're going off to your country, and I want you to email if you can. If you can do it, post this sort of email onto a newsgroup that I read regularly. Now that person is posting it, and no agent who's watching knows who picks it up. And you could also disguise it. You can do all your other good security things. But the email network, because it's a large public network that everyone can access, can really act as a dead drop. It's very similar to classified ads, which have been used in the past to activate Soviet agents in the U.S. If a classified ad of a certain type appears, call this phone number. It means there are instructions waiting for you. We can do that on, rec recipes. If a really good chocolate chip cookbook recipe shows up, this means something is going on. And we can make that work. And we're going to add steganography. I'm going to talk about steganography later because it's really its own topic. Right, in a pinch, we can use email. If we set up our signaling rights, sending email can be used as a way to communicate covertly. What we're leveraging here is a very, very large public communications network. And the hope is we can flow in and out of it without being seen. The big problem for military intelligence organizations is not really decrypting data, although I'm sure that's a problem. It's figuring out what is worth looking at. You have gigabytes of data a day. You're drinking from a fire hose. You have to make decisions, really in a split second. Is this piece of information worth saving, worth studying, worth decrypting, worth analyzing? Or should I go on to the next piece of information? Right? I can save it, but I'm getting so much, I'll never get back to what I saved unless I have a reason to. So there's a lot to be gained figuring out how not to be seen, how to move through this this network invisibly. Another common spy tool used for sending binary messages is Semaphore. And this is a signal. In the John Walker spy case, this is Albert James. There was a mailbox on a route he would walk regularly. And if there was a chalk X on that mailbox, it meant he should do some action. That's a good example of a semaphore. Now, the characteristics here is the person receiving it should not change his actions in order to receive the semaphore. You want to put it someplace he sees regularly. Otherwise, somebody watching him will notice that, once a week he always does this. I wonder what's going on. But if it's on the person's route to work every day, then it flows seamlessly into his life, and you can send these sorts of messages. This is, again, very easy to do on the net with newsgroups. If a certain message appears, as long as the person who is receiving it regularly visits that newsgroup. If you visit it once a week at 4 o'clock to see if the message is there, that is going to look suspicious. But if you regularly read both whatever binaries, then it's easy. Now, one thing we can do on computers that we couldn't do with these pencil paper systems, these manual systems, is steganography. And I want to talk a bit about steganography because I believe it's one of the most misunderstood things about security right now. People believe it can do a lot more than it can. Steganography is the science of hiding the existence of a message. And there are programs you can download that do steganography. Most of them take a picture. They take a GIF image, or is it a GIF? I don't know. Is it a GIF? Right. Take a GIF image, I feel so cool. And hide the message in the low order bit of the red. And it's something that barely affects image quality. And I send it to my recipient, who knows it's there, use the same steganography program, pull out the image and pull out the bits on the image and read the message. Okay, now that sounds really good, but let's think about that back in our terms of the Chinese dissident. Here's a person who might be watched by the Chinese police to see whether he's passing secure messages. That can very well, I'd rather it be me in a country. Now, I have this message I want to send to the recipient, to the Human Rights Observer, so I send him a GIF. Now, I have never sent a GIF in my life. I have never received a GIF in my life. If someone who's watching me, and suddenly I send 3 GIFs a day, they're going to think something's up. And moreover, they're probably going to look at that image. It's an image of a giraffe. Well, did I send the same image of a giraffe that was a little bit different each time I sent a message? If I did, that's immediately suspicious. Can the intelligence agency send some automatic agent to scour the net for an image that's almost exactly the same except for the low order bit? Well, that's pretty damning. So if I needed to do this, I would need to, one, take a photograph myself, scan it in so that it didn't appear on the network in any other form, embed that message, send it, and even more difficult, I would need a plausible cover story of why I'm sending GIF messages to this person. And that's very hard to construct. Steganography works, but it only works in situations where using it does not change your communications patterns. If you change your communications patterns while using steganography, you're effectively telegraphing that you're sending a message. And why else would this photographer start sending gifs of a giraffe across the country? Must be suspicious. So I worry a lot about the steganography programs out there. And about a year ago, I was asked to write a few paragraphs on steganography for Amnesty International's pamphlet on this sort of thing. And I tried to make this very clear. I don't want someone to start using steganography believing that someone won't know they're communicating. It often doesn't work that way. Now I want to talk a little bit about hiding places. This is something very important to a spy. A spy assumes that at some point his house will be searched, his person will be searched, and evidence will be found. And if you're good, you can try to hide your stuff in good places. You can hide yourself stuff in public places where you hope it's not found. You can hide your stuff in your own home, hopefully well. There are a couple of different types of hiding places. One is a deep hiding place, and I don't know the tradecraft term for it, but some place is a very good hiding place. It might take you an hour to get whatever it is out of that hiding place. Maybe it's buried somewhere. Maybe it's under a piece of concrete. The other kind of hiding place is known in the literature as a slick. This is a fast hiding place, a place where you can dump something in 5-10 seconds. Inside a curtain rod. So anybody who's been a teenager knows about this stuff. You need a place to dump stuff quickly, which might not be as secure, and a place to dump stuff long term. This is really hard to do on the net. About a year ago, I started researching, building something which I called a deniable file system. And the idea is, this is one better than an encrypted file system. With an encrypted file system, there are encrypted files on your hard drive. And presumably, if your door is bust down by some goon squad that doesn't have to follow any written laws, they can do what we call rubber hose script analysis and beat the key out of you. You laugh, but it's serious if you're receiving end of this. Now, what I wanted to do is design a file system where you couldn't tell there were secret files there. When you typed your key in, the files would appear. When you didn't type your key in, the files would be invisible. And they'd be invisible from the file system. So if you didn't type your key in, and you worked and created deleted files, you would probably overwrite some of your stuff. But it was completely deniable. So let's start thinking this through. And I did see this one to ask him. I believe Adam Shopstack is the person who explained to me why this might be worse. Was it you? Okay, we had this conversation though. Yeah, you were the one who didn't directly explain it, you made me realize it. But the real problem with this, and the problem is that when your door is broken down and the goons start beating you up for your key, you have the option of giving them your key. And when you do that, they stop beating you. Because they have your files and they're all decrypted and they've got all the data. If you're using a deniable file system and the goons beat your door down, they'll look at your computer and they'll see you have a deniable file system installed. Slew 1. I didn't install that. I don't have any files. That wasn't me. That was the person I bought the computer from. You're not going to be believed. And the problem with the deniable file system is that you can set it up so that the goons never know that they've gotten all your data. My goal is to set up the different stages of this, different levels. You could be in a position where you couldn't make them stop beating you. You couldn't say, you have everything. Go away now. I'm just going to heal over here. And this was you, wasn't it? It was you and Ron. Okay. And that's the sort of issues you face when you're trying to build these systems. You're dealing with an adversary that's not going to behave according to any reasonable set of rules. And having the ability to say, these are my secrets, you have the entire computer, you're done now, might be a very useful thing to do. Another system that I heard about later, and this is used by someone in a country, I'd rather not say which, who's documenting human rights abuses. He wrote a program that if his door is broken down, it's a panic button. And you can write panic buttons that erase things. That's probably a good idea in this situation. This is actually a better panic button. Because if a panic button that erases things, you're kind of stuck because you erased everything, so false alarms are really annoying. What this panic button does is that when you push the panic button, his files were encrypted in the public key of some of the Embassy National's offices in the UK. That's a really nice system because it solves the problem of, one, if it's a false alarm, it's annoying but possible to recover your data. If the goons break down your door, your files are encrypted, and you don't have the key to decrypt it. And if the goons knew anything, they would know that. You could, in theory, prove, I can't decrypt this. It's the public key of this guy in the UK. Go get him. And my thoughts, and something I'd like to do in my copious free time, is to combine this with some sort of system where the program would encrypt the files in the public key, delete it off the FAT, and then delete the program. So it would erase itself and then just disappear. And then you would have, if you wanted, you would have deniability. If you lost that deniability through whatever covert means the enemy took that from you, you still wouldn't give out the information. I think that's kind of neat. Now, I'm probably going to close soon and then I'll take a whole bunch of questions. So don't leave me waiting here for a second. If people are interested in this, a couple of years ago, I was talking to a CIA agent in a forum where he was willing to talk a little bit. And one of the questions he was willing to answer, this was a good question to ask. I asked, which fiction book published gives the most accurate account of how agents work in the real world? Which fiction author got it right? And the book he suggested, and it's a book I've known and enjoyed many times, is John le Carré's Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. And that's serious. And if you're interested in this sort of side area of secrecy and confidentiality, it is worth reading those books to get a feel for the kinds of real problems agents and dissidents face. And I think we can do a lot of good by building tools that will help dissidents in China, or East Timor, in many countries where they don't enjoy even the freedoms we enjoy. And that's my pitch. I ended early because I know there are always lots of questions on every topic of cryptography, so I'll why don't we have like the first one or two on topic, if possible, otherwise we can throw it over to anything under the sun. How am I going to keep that guy from beating up because he's pissing me? I can't, there's no technological solution to that problem. Yes, I cannot stop gratuitous violence. And I understand that. Now, one of the important things to do with any security product is understand what you can solve and what you can't solve. You solve what you can, and you accept, and you even publicize that you can solve what you can't. Right? We who write PGP cannot solve the problem of keyboard sniffers. We're sorry, you're vulnerable. So yes, I'm taking a slice of the problem. I think it's solvable. I'm trying to bear three tools there with that. The question is about key space. This is probably a good question to spend a few minutes on. This afternoon, Paul Kotcher came in late last night, and he and his gang have brought some props from the from Deep Crack, from the Desk Cracker, and I know he'll be talking about it. Oh, sometime when?
Yeah.
Anybody? Sometime, I think like 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock. sometime in that area. So he can, I mean, he'll probably have a lot to say about that. I'll talk about key lengths in general for a minute or two and let him follow that. Brute force attacks are pretty easy to characterize because they're trying every possible key. So the attack scales perfectly. And just like they built a machine to attack 56-bit keys in 2.5 days, I think it is, on the average, you can calculate exactly how big, how expensive, how slow machines to attack larger key lengths. When you start getting to 128-bit keys, brute force attacks require, you know, more time than the age of the universe. They require computers bigger than the number of atoms in the galaxy, in the universe, you know, not counting dark matter. But you get into such huge numbers that you can say, or even with a quantum computer, which, if the theory is correct, will reduce any computation by factor square roots, you can start building key lengths very easily that will be immune against brute force attacks. Until computers are made out of something other than matter and occupy something other than space. The laws of physics just kill you. So, while yes, 56-bit keys have been broken by militaries for years, we knew that, there's no news there. 64-bit keys certainly are vulnerable. We did a paper, a bunch of photographers, a few years ago, that said 90-bit keys were bare minimum for security. I would probably say 96 right now. 128-bit will probably be forever immune. And the new AES, the DES replacement, NIST is requesting that the new AES have 128-bit key, 192-bit key, and 256-bit key. And these will be forever immune. However, that's never your weak link. If you look at PGP uses 128-bit keys. Those keys are protected by a passphrase. Anyone who attacks PGP will attack the passphrase. You probably need a 7 or 8 line passphrase to get 128 bits of entropy. So while we can make key lengths large enough to avoid brute force attacks, you must always assume that there are smarter attacks. No one ever does the easy one, the obvious hard one. And Paul will do more about key lengths, so let's take the rest of the stuff. Oh, back there in the red.
What happens when you try to transfer information to someone who's not necessarily looking for it?
That's hard. It's hard for me to talk to somebody who's walking away. And that, you know, and it's the same problem. You can either shout, right? You transmit loud enough or strong enough that you get their attention, or you can't do it. A lot of what you look at in spying, there's a lot of paying attention and being bored. You're going to look at that damn mailbox every week of your life. You might get one message. But that message might be, get out of town, the police are onto you. So you learn to look. But yes, there's a lot of... you almost can't. In spying, there are often emergency provisions that are set up. You know, when the ship comes down, you call this phone number. And the CIA has this. They have phone numbers that are just random phone numbers that people just call. And when someone picks it up, they know, gets on the computer screen, who's calling, why they're calling, you know, what the procedures were for this call. And you memorize that phone number. But yes, you have to pay attention. Or otherwise, it's like this lot to spell false part. Oh, wait a minute. That's good, and that's something I actually haven't looked into at all. A lot of us got in trade grant is setting up legends, setting up personas, setting up sleeping persona. If you're an agent in the field, you want a second entity that lives in a box somewhere that you can pick up and assume if you need. Now, that's not my area of expertise. The paper trip people can talk to that. Sure, I believe there's a lot you can do, especially if you're the government. It's real easy to set up an identity. For an agent operating in a country where you have control over computer networks. Okay, that's way out of my league. Do you have any preferences for steganography? I think they're all pretty good. I mean, they're all the thing about steganography is understand that the adversary will see the program on your computer. So I would like one I can download and delete each time. Well, they're going to see you download it. So we want to set up a secure connection there, and a plausible reason to download things. And you want to use it in instances where you can mask the reason you're sending the communications. The program is basically the same. I haven't looked at it. You know, you'll use an encryption program underneath it. It'll do all the smart things. But no, I actually don't have recognition. Oh, standing up over there. There's a lot of folklore on that, about overwriting files on your disk drive. Certainly overwriting one solves against any normal software program. A number of years ago, I saw an image taken from an electron tunneling microscope of a hard drive, and it was fascinating. What they showed, you saw the bits stored on the film, and you saw subsequent bits overwriting the previous bit, and the previous bits pushed down, almost like strata that you see in a mountain. And you could see clearly 7 or 8. Now, there's a lot of money bringing to bear to read that data at that point. And I don't know how the economics of that will work. I know that the government believes that when you have classified magnetic media and you want to declassify it, you use a metal shredder. You don't use a degausser. You don't overwrite it sometimes. There are DoD guidelines for overwriting. Really, and you see them at the FCA trade show. It's like a giant chipper, and you can throw hard drives into it, not just paper. So the answer is I don't know. You want to be really conservative. I think I filled the number out to 15. And if you have a program running in the background, you might as well, you know, erase your data while you sleep and do it 20 billion times. It can't hurt. I don't really answer that, and that's a tough question. That's a physics question.
Okay.
Yeah, have you considered the combination of your deniable file system and then a panic button that undoes the software? One, in terms of if you're truly deniable at that point, and then, but that even removes the deniability from someone who didn't do it.
Yeah, I talked about that. The panic button will erase the software. I worry about attacks that happen too quickly, where you know you can't push the panic button. And I hear lots of stories of FBI breaking the hackers with guns drawn, saying "Get away, step away from the keyboard," because they assume the hackers can push one button and you know drop the Fed. So any solution you really. Any solution you come up with will never fail in the use, it'll fail around the edges. So you want to be very careful about those. But yeah, that's certainly something we look at. And if I ever do this, we'll have something like that. So who really wants to go? Or will it fail? Subliminal channels is a good thing to talk about. It's sort of related. Subliminal channel is effectively like steganography. There are a number of cryptographic primitives that can be used to hide information. And you'll read about some corporate espionage cases where subliminal channels were used in the spacing of a report would leak a key. So the attacker would drop a Trojan horse in that would steal information through some secret channel. It's actually a lot easier now because you can just dump stuff out the TCP/IP ports and no one really pays attention. Those sorts of subliminal channels aren't really as useful. There are subliminal channels in digital signature schemes. Again, you have the problem of the software you have on your computer will be obviously designed to take advantage of that, and that's a problem. There are some protocols used. I've seen some anti-counterfeiting protocols where subliminal channels are in there. I've seen some voting protocols where one of the problems with voting over the net is you can sell your vote and prove that you delivered on the goods. And you know, we inside don't want that. I mean, you can sell your vote, but you walk into the voting booth, you can vote how you please. And that's a nice safety net. But with electronic voting, someone can walk into your computer room and say, okay, here's $20, move over, I'm going to vote for you. And there are some systems in the literature that use subliminal channels in a way to say this is a true vote, this is a coerced vote, in such a way that it is impossible for someone looking over your shoulder to tell. So there are some uses for that, and not as big as I like to think. Next over there. That is you. You want to turn around? I don't know it. Generally, stuff that comes out of cyberpunks, because it comes out of a public forum, it's written in public, and it's cross-vetted by each other, it's generally pretty good. You don't see the overly same level of incompetence you see when a company in their proprietary offices builds something and throws it out there. So I do not know the Linux idea file system. Now, if I was going to ask anyone here, then I'd probably ask Ian first and see who you tell me to ask. But, you know, it's probably better than other stuff you find. Archiving data on the net, that's actually really, yeah, and I forgot to mention that. I have a written question. Actually, it's a written comment, so it's repeat questions. The question was about archiving data on the net. That's something I just forgot to write down. That's worth doing. I mean, many pieces of the net are permanently archived. And dumping data in one of those archives, and you get your own scanner and pull some 50-year-old copy of Playboy and start scanning in pictures and dropping steganographic data in there, posting them somewhere, they'll get archived somewhere and you can get them down later. You know, that's actually a really useful tool. Okay, thanks for that, because I forgot. Adam. That's a bit too long to repeat. Again, he's reiterating the problem of deniability cuts both ways. You sometimes want to be able to say you've got all my secrets. Again, it depends. If you downloaded a program, if the program was deleted and the files were deleted, you're in the same boat as if you actually were innocent under some threat models. You're suspected, you have nothing incriminating on your computer. So then you're kind of stuck either way. I guess the moral might be to have something incriminating just not buried, sort of ready as a standby. And this sort of thing was used. There were a couple of Israeli spies in the U.S. who were caught, and I don't know how. I suspect this was a political deal, but they were convicted of dealing in copper secrets and manipulating the copper market, and that seemed really implausible to me. But that's an example of having a slightly illegal cover story to mask a highly illegal real story. And if you're a Chinese dissident, that might be a useful thing. Way, way in the back. How does a Chinese dissident get the message to Amnesty International? Generally, the way it works in the real world is all of this starts with face-to-face meetings. You know, this is just communication that goes on after relationships have been established. A lot of the movement of human rights information on this planet happens because people go out and put themselves at considerable personal risk to try to expose some of these abuses. So I'm trying to talk about automatic communications after the dissident has been identified by the good guys and has been is willing to talk. And this meeting might be completely anonymous. No one might know the name of anybody. Or maybe the Amnesty International official might have his name known. This net might just be some anonymous person who has now connected to communicate. What's important in these cases is we get documentation out, that we get some sort of proof out that hopefully the press will listen to. What I think of Peter Wainer's mimic functions, people don't know this. It's actually kind of neat. It's a steganographic program, and what it does is it takes an arbitrary grammar and encodes messages in it. So you can, in theory, encode all of your encrypted information into meaningless chatter about baseball. And that was one of his examples. He took, it chewed up four or five play-by-play announcements and would spew out information. This works pretty well against some kinds of attacks. The attack you're assuming is there is some big computer somewhere that's filtering all of Usenet, all of the internet, and looking for keywords, key phrases. And if you are just mindless chatter about baseball, or stock quotes, or you know something boring, the parser will just fall asleep and go to the next message. That works real well against those sorts of adversaries. And steganography, I mean, it's just steganography. Pictures work the same way. So it's another example of hiding against automatic searchers. A person will look at Peter Weyman's minute function and say, this is obviously meaningless, there's something here. But if you're a computer, it's much harder, because as a computer you're being trained to parse sentences and look for something interesting. And this is by definition boring. I don't know. You know, people with higher budgets than I are dealing with this problem. And do they have a solution? Don't know. Don't think so, but don't know.
Oh, let's go there.
He's talking about, and this is a serious problem, the problem of, by virtue of downloading the secrecy program, you are putting a big target on yourself. To me, this is a bigger problem than just this, and I know later today there's a talk from Zero Knowledge about anonymous web browsing and anonymous news groups, anonymous FTP. And my hope is those sorts of tools, if they become ubiquitous, people will be using them generally, and someone who uses the tool to download a secrecy tool won't be immediately suspicious. But yes, that's a problem. In some instances, you might actually have to hand a floppy disk to somebody and say, I want you to communicate using this tool, and here it is. Here is a copy. Okay. Don't ever underestimate, especially in these situations, the power of giving data through Sneakernet. It's a really nice covert network.
Spoofable.
I'm sorry?
It's
spoofable. They're all spoofable. Unfortunately. Well, the noise is up, but I don't know what the... This is a question about finding secrecy programs, make them look like normal shareware. My belief is that's never going to work, really, because they look like what they are. I mean, it doesn't take much to assemble a product and see what it does. You have to assume your adversary is extremely well-funded and extremely well-motivated. Right? This is Indonesia. They want to stop these people. And they're going to throw a lot of money at the problem. So if I have a product that looks like something else, and it'll fool some of the people some of the time, but that's not the space I'm thinking in. I'm thinking of the places where that won't work. And a lot of this is understanding what the problem is. Next thing. Yeah, if you have 5 gigabytes of data, it's going to be really hard to transfer over a network anonymously. And at that point, you take yourself a zip disk or whatever and do it manually. That's probably way too much data to communicate. Which is what you see when you see all these spy messages historically, is they're very short. They're 10 lines, they're 15 lines. Whenever there was real data to communicate, you use a face-to-face meeting. Because they're going to have questions. This isn't conversation. This is, bad stuff has happened, go here, do this, get out. This is, a person is having, the police is on this person, go there, help them if you can. It's that sort of data. We're not looking to have, chatty conversations. Occasionally, one of the most important things you can send to a sleeper agent is a letter from home. And sometimes a lot of care was taken sending those. Because the biggest problem is often morale. So sending connections from home is often very important. I'm taking two more, then I'm going to get up stage. We're going to keep this on time. Over there. I can't hear a word you're saying.
Yeah,
This is the dependability of the what feature? I don't know, Doug. I don't know the dependability of this. Anything else? One in the back, and that'll be the last question. I'm going to get off stage. Yes? He's talking about basically about good viruses, and there's been a lot of talk about it in the past couple of years. Can we have viruses that do good things? Right? And switching NetSafe from domestic to international, I'm sorry, international to domestic, is a really good perverse use that I missed. But you know, you can in theory use viruses to update. I believe that the STU-3, which is the U.S. military secure telephone, and it's all classified, the algorithms and whatever, that they had some sort of viral system for moving lists of bad phones through the systems. The idea would be that a bad list would enter, and when two phones would communicate, they would compare their lists and would both update. And that would virally propagate through the network. Certainly there are some really good uses for the notion of a self-replicating program that does things. You've probably got to pick another name than virus in one market. That's just my feeling. But yes, I think there's some really good legitimate uses of that. And I'd love to see research in that. Because viruses have been so tainted because of their evil effects that people don't realize that it's a good way to move information through a distributed, highly distributed system, especially if your network's well interconnected. And I'm sorry, I'm gonna clear the stage. I'd love to talk about this with people who have ideas, and feel free to stop me and ask me about anything else. It's always fun to be here, and thanks for having me. I have no idea.